Today on the Bible Reading Challenge podcast, we are going to give an overview of a book with many pronunciations, Philemon. I'm not sure, whatever you call it, we are going to discuss it. And to help us do this, we have a special guest joining us. Pastor Stephen Wedgeworth is the Associate Pastor of Faith Reformed Presbyterian Church in Vancouver, BC. Yes, he is in Canada. He has taught humanities at Christian high schools in the U.S., and he occasionally writes on church history, philosophy, and politics over at the Calvinist International. Stephen is married to Anna, and they have three children. Stephen, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, good to be here, Aaron.
And are you still pretty active on Calvinist International? Are you writing other places as well? People want to find your stuff.
The Calvinist International is still there, and we publish just kind of whenever people want to, myself and a few other authors. It's kind of known for having longer articles or maybe more kind of technical stuff, so it's not the kind of blog that's dependent on, you know, weekly content. Yeah. But lately I haven't been publishing a whole lot there because I've just been focusing on the church, and also I've gotten some requests to write for other groups like Desiring God, Council for Biblical Manhood and Womanhood, and so I just sort of been waiting and sending occasional essays and articles to other groups, and probably will do more on the website, you know, over the years, but just right now doing a little work elsewhere.
Yeah. So if people who are just listening to this, they hear your accent and they wonder, so this guy's up in Canada. Can you tell us a little bit about what it's like being a Southerner in the North and how you ended up pastoring over there?
Yeah, well, this accent is not as thick as it used to be. I was born in Mississippi, grew up in South Mississippi, and was there for about 30 years. Went to seminary there, Reformed Theological Seminary in Jackson. Then took a church in Central Florida. So my family moved down there. We were in Florida, not far from Tampa, for about 4 years. And that was kind of our transition point, because Florida is a place where everyone moves there. You know, not a lot of locals there anymore. And then as I was leaving Florida, I was just kind of looking for other, I felt that I was being called to go somewhere else, but I didn't really have a clear, you know, destination in mind. So I was talking with some various friends, and particularly Mark Jones, who is the senior pastor here. I just thought of him as a guy who had a wide network. So I said, hey, if you know of anyone looking for a pastor, appreciate putting my name out there. He sort of popped the idea to come to Vancouver. Church here is growing. They're going to plant a second church and needed more help. So after thinking that was kind of crazy at first, eventually my wife and I made a visit, checked it out, really enjoyed our time here. We liked the church and all the opportunities. So we accepted the call. And so the church here is pretty exciting. We have one main church, but we're in the process of planting a church in a neighboring suburb. But we're just sort of going slow with that process. So right now you could call us a multi-site church. Not quite what that sounds like. You know, we have.
Are you guys like up on the screen simulcasting?
No. No, we always have an actual pastor, you know, in the pulpit.
Okay.
But it's one governing session over both locations right now. It's a transition model. We don't want to do that forever, but it was just a way to keep everybody unified, because we were sending a group from the main church to the new plant, and we didn't want them to have a ton of pressure and, you know, have to be kind of battling uphill for resources and finances and getting organizational things taken care of.
Yeah,
really wanted to have a solid church group that we could be drawing new members from the community to. So that's been the model. And so at the main location, before we had to shut things down for COVID, at the main location in Vancouver, in the city, we had, you know, about 200 people. And then we planted a church in a neighboring suburb called Surrey, and we got up to about 90 regular attenders there. So I feel like it's been a pretty good start so far.
Yeah.
With coronavirus, we lost our building in Surrey. We were meeting in a school. Hopefully we can get back to that in a few months, but we haven't been able to meet there, so we're back kind of in one location. We are able to meet in Vancouver, but we have to have smaller services. So we do three services on Sunday, and only 50 members can attend at a time right now. So a little bit of a strange season, but we're happy and thankful that we can meet and do what we're doing. And we've noticed it's been an interesting opportunity, right? We're videoing our stuff now. We never did that before. And so we get contact from people who watch the sermons, even people who didn't, you know, don't attend church necessarily. And we've had a lot of visitors lately, you know, I guess there aren't that many churches having services. So the last several weeks we've had, you know, between 5 to even sometimes 10 visitors in the room, and it's a max of 50 people, right? So it's been pretty encouraging.
Yeah. It is really funny. I've, you know, doing this podcast, talking to other pastors in other places, that seems to be a recurring theme, is that for those churches that, that are meeting or trying to make it work, a lot of new visitors happen to be coming by, either, you know, some unbelievers, some from other churches that maybe aren't meeting. So it is a really strange time to be doing ministry. I don't know if Nassim Taleb calls this a black swan or not, but definitely it seems like no one really saw this coming, but here we are. Well, today we're talking about a book that's only one chapter long. It's super short. And maybe before I keep saying it incorrectly, so I think I grew up calling it Philemon, and I'm probably just gonna keep with that. But I know that's the incorrect pronunciation. Yeah. How do you pronounce it, and why?
Yeah, this is, every time I have a conversation about this book, this is like the first thing you have to say, right? Because I grew up saying it Philemon, kind of all soft vowels, and that's actually one acceptable pronunciation. I looked up the various academic sources, and that one is acceptable. But then, like you, as I got older, I switched. I started calling it Philemon. And I think the reason that we do that is, like, you know, all the famous British preachers that we hear on, you know, audio, that's sort of a British pronunciation, Philemon. But it's most likely not correct, right? Of all the options, that one probably doesn't work when you look at Greek, because that opening vowel sound, it's a softer I sound. It's not phi. It's either phi, or it could even be phi. You know, there's debates over how the Greek pronunciation changed over the years. So from what I can tell, probably the better way to say it is Philemon.
Philemon.
So you can keep that long E if you want, if that sounds more natural, but it's a softer, shorter I, a vowel at the beginning. So I've been saying Philemon.
Okay.
But yeah, I grant people, you know, their right to pronounce it however they want.
Is this Adiaphora? That's the real question.
Yes.
So Philemon, I'll see if I can do that for most of this podcast, but I probably will fall into my old ruts. But I want to talk about a little bit about the background for this book. And, you know, it probably takes, I don't know, 2 minutes to read it straight through. You know, it's shorter than an email, definitely shorter than a Calvinist International blog post, you know. And the more that I was studying and preparing for it, the more I was just thinking, man, I mean, you could preach like 3 sermons at least on this. You know, there's just so much here, a lot of interesting stuff related to things like slavery, liberation, social hierarchies, providence, the church. And what was, in some ways, what's fascinating to me is not just what's in the letter, but also what's not in the letter, and we can get more into that. So can you set us up? What was the occasion for Paul writing this letter, and who are kind of the key players in it?
Yeah, so this letter, as you say, it's super short, 25 verses. And we know that Paul wrote predominantly, you know, all the material we have from him are in the form of letters. But most of his letters, you know, you still get the feeling that they were written for a group audience. You know, they're to the whole church. They're to be read out loud. So we call them letters, but for the most part, we still treat them like books. But this one, it really just looks like a letter that you would write your friend, right? It's from Paul to this man named Philemon, who is a Christian that Paul has come into encountered over the years. And it's sort of one man writing to another man, and it's about a personal situation. And so this is where it gets a little bit, interesting and controversial. Paul has come across Philemon's runaway slave. So Philemon owned a slave whose name is Onesimus. We're introduced to him later on in verse 10. And so Onesimus ran away, and at some point he comes into Paul's orbit. He meets Paul and is converted by Paul. Paul actually says that Onesimus has been born to him. That's in verse 10. He calls him my son Onesimus, whom I have begotten while in my chains. So if we kind of put that together, probably Paul is in prison, and Onesimus maybe is also in prison. He doesn't say that explicitly, but a runaway slave, maybe got into trouble again. He meets Paul and is converted by Paul. And so Paul looks at him now as a brother. But the hook, or maybe the strange twist of this letter, is that Paul sends Onesimus back home. Sends him back to his original master, to Philemon, and that's what this letter is all about. Paul is explaining why he's returning Onesimus, and he's making an argument, though subtly, not explicitly, he's making an argument on how he wants Onesimus to be treated. And my reading of this book, and this is sort of my main argument whenever I preach on this, present it, I believe Paul is making an argument for Onesimus to be set free, to be liberated from slavery, and to be treated as a free man and a brother in the church, and that will carry out into the rest of life. And so the letter is, it's personal, you know, it's one man writing to another man about this situation that's happened. But when you start meditating on the meaning of what's happened and what Paul's really asking Philemon to do for Onesimus, then you can see how this is really the gospel action. Mm-hmm. Paul is applying the gospel to a social situation, and he's expecting it to have a transformation effect.
Yeah.
This man, the slave, has come to Paul. He's been converted and born again. And now he's sent back home, but he's sent back home with a new identity and a new status.
Yeah. So right at the beginning, and I think I heard you mention this in a sermon I listened to from you, where he kind of CCs, if this is an email, he kind of CCs some other people. Yeah. Can you explain the significance of including these other people and who those other people might be?
Yeah, it's a really fun point, because again, we have these habits when we read the Bible, and in Paul's letters, we know, like I say, we know their letters, so they always start off, you know, Paul, a prisoner of Christ Jesus, and then he'll list a few other people who are with him, and probably most of us don't really stop and think about that so much. We read it and then move on looking for the stuff that we're really after. But here it's pretty important because, again, I said it's this personal letter, one man to another man, but that's actually not the whole story. So look at the opening verses of Philemon. It says, Paul, a prisoner of Christ Jesus, and Timothy, our brother. Mm-hmm. Paul and Timothy are involved here. To Philemon, our beloved friend and fellow laborer, to the beloved Apphia, this is a female, and most likely it's Philemon's wife. We don't know that with 100% certainty, but the commentators, they all opt for that. So to Philemon, to his wife Apphia, and then there's a third name, Archippus, our fellow soldier, and to the church in your house. So Paul is writing it to at least three people and then the church. That gives it more of a public status. But if you look up Archippus, do a keyword search in your Bible software on the web, you'll find out that his name shows up in Colossians chapter 4, verse 17. And in Colossians 4:17, Archippus appears to be a pastor. So Paul is writing this letter to Philemon, but he's including a wife and a pastor in the conversation. So that is important because that, again, shows you that Paul wants more people to know about this. You know, other people are in on the conversation. And it does add a little bit of pressure, right? As you said, a CC. If you get an email and you see there are a bunch of other names who also got that email, well, okay. Now they know you got it. They know what's in it. And they can, you know, be expecting your reply. And in this case, they can expect Philemon to do the right thing. So Paul's being very strategic in his letter.
Yeah, I think Calvin may have said that Philemon is likely a pastor, and he argues from him calling him his fellow laborer. Do you take that view, and does that matter?
It's certainly possible. Philemon could be a pastor. He could also just be a leader in the church, you know, a wealthy patron, somebody who maybe has donated to Paul's missionary work. It could be elder or deacon even. We don't know for sure. Archippus seems to be a pastor because of his appearance in Colossians, and also given the title fellow soldier seems to be a little bit different, right? Philemon is a laborer, but Archippus is a soldier. But yeah, they could all be officers. It's possible. But it could also be the case that Philemon is just a significant lay leader, you know, as well. That's possible.
Yeah. So can you now take us into the argument for why you believe that Paul is trying to get, or you're saying indirectly asking him to liberate Onesimus? Can you talk about how you kind of get there, and then why some people would take a different view perhaps than that one?
Yeah. So this to me is the heart of the letter. It's kind of what it's all building up to. And not everyone believes that Paul's calling for Onesimus to be freed. Right. I would say today that's a pretty popular view. In fact, what's hard is just to get people to understand and accept the reality that there were slave owners in the first century church. You know, that's shocking. You have to spend a lot of time setting the context and telling people why that could be the case, and really forcing them to meditate on what that would mean, you know, the mm-hmm. fact that there would be this messy political situation in the first century. But we're all primed to see freedom. We're expecting that. So today we're very happy to read it the way I'm suggesting. But throughout a lot of the church, they didn't see that, because it isn't explicit. Paul doesn't just say, set him free. He doesn't come out and say that. So if you read some of the early church fathers, John Chrysostom has a commentary on this book. If you read Martin Luther, he's got a commentary on this book, or even Calvin. Basically, they only say that Paul is asking for Onesimus to be treated kindly, mm-hmm. You know, for Philemon not to exact revenge, not to beat him up, or to be a harsh master. But they really only say, you know, he's being asked to be treated kindly. They don't go any farther than that because it's not explicit. But I think it's in here because this is such a rhetorical letter. Rhetorical doesn't mean, you know, sneaky. It doesn't mean he's trying to fool everybody, but he's using his speech in a very specific way, and he wants Philemon to come to this decision as if it is his own decision, right? He's trying to persuade him to voluntarily.
Of the Apostle Paul.
Yeah, he's trying to persuade him to voluntarily do this.
Yeah.
And so a couple of things here that set the stage, right? So verse 8, I might be very bold in Christ to command you what is fitting. Right. So, you know, if I wanted to, I could tell you. Yeah. I could make you do this. But for love's sake, I rather appeal to you. So you can see Paul setting the stage here. You know, I could command you, but I would rather appeal to you. And in verse 14, without your consent, I wanted to do nothing, so that your good deed might not be by compulsion, but as it were, voluntary. Mm-hmm. So we're loading up the leverage here. Really want you to do this. We want you to want to do this. That's my argument, trying to persuade you. However, Paul, he's not above a little bit of, manipulation would be a strong word because we assume that means he's being mean or immoral, but Paul's not above leveraging his own personal history with Philemon. So look at verse 21. verse 19 and then 21. So verse 19, he says, I, Paul, writing with my own hand, I will repay, so whatever Onesimus owes, Paul will pay for it. But then look at the ending of verse 19. Yeah. Not to mention to you that you owe me even your own self. So, you've got this appeal to, we want you to do this on your own, right? I'm not going to make you do this. I'm not going to command you. But don't forget, you owe me. And then in verse 21, having confidence in your obedience, I write to you, knowing you will do even more than I say. So you've gotta give these clues, these rhetorical clues, a lot of weight, right? Yeah. Paul says, I'm asking for more than I'm asking for. I want you to do what I'm asking, but I want it to be your idea, and I'm sure you're going to go above and beyond. So that, to me, right away, lets you know how to read this letter. Mm-hmm. If you read it just in a wooden, literal way, and say, oh, but he didn't explicitly ask for this or that, then you're missing how the letter works.
Yeah.
And we're familiar with this in social relations, obviously marriage. You definitely need to learn how to hear what the other person is saying, even if they're not saying it all the way. But it's true in the church as well. So Paul, he's asking for something, but he's putting it in a certain rhetorical way. Now, what else is he saying here? Well, Paul talks about how important Onesimus is to him. He's his son. Verse 11, Onesimus was unprofitable to you, but now is profitable to you and to me. And verse 13, I wish to keep him with me, that on your behalf he might minister to me in my chains. So he's profitable, and I really want to keep him, but I don't want to take him away from you without your permission. Mm-hmm. And then I think what finally sells the point that he wants him to be freed are verse 15 and 16, and really even all the way to 17. Paul says, perhaps he departed for a while for this purpose, that you might receive him forever, no longer as a slave, but more than a slave, a beloved brother, especially to me, but how much more to you, both in the flesh and in the Lord. If then you count me as a partner, receive him as you would me. So those verses, in my mind, drive home the point. Paul says, take him back, but not as a slave, but more than a slave, as a brother in the flesh and in the Lord. Now, in the flesh and in the Lord is really important because sometimes flesh means sin, right? Your sinful flesh abiding in you. The flesh is what draws you back into sin, right? That's a common usage of it. But I don't think that's what he means here. It wouldn't make sense, right? He would be a brother in sin. No, that's not the point. But his point is he's a brother now in the flesh and in the Lord, which is to mean both spiritually and in the world, in real life, in the temporal world. Because you could call him a brother in the Lord, right? We do this all the time. Brother, how you doing, brother? And that doesn't mean we're actually brothers. And you could imagine the slave master saying, hey, of course we're brothers in Christ, but I'm still the master. He's still the slave. Spiritually, we're brothers. But in the rest of life, we have this hierarchical relationship. And so I think Paul is making the point that he's not only asking for spiritual brotherhood. He's already got spiritual brotherhood. He wants him to be treated as a brother in the flesh and in the Lord. And then if you count me as your partner, receive him as you would receive me. So people are reading this letter, you know, Philemon's wife is reading this letter, his pastor is reading this letter. They know Paul wants Onesimus to be treated like Paul. So what would it mean? How would people interpret it if you receive Onesimus back and you put him in chains and you start treating him like a slave? And sure, you're nice to him, but he still doesn't get to go out and serve the church in a broader way. He can't, you know, can't hold office. He can't go out and do these other things. He's just limited to the life of a slave. I don't think people would buy it. They say, hey, that's not how you would treat Paul. That's not what Paul's asking for here. And so Paul is really hammering home in a way that shows the gospel transforming the whole community, right? Really, this is kind of like a Good Samaritan. Paul has taken this guy who was helpless and needy, and he's taken care of him. And then he says, hey, if he owes you anything, charge it to me. I'll take care of it. But then he goes a step further and says, treat him like me. He's me until I'm here. And in fact, in verse 17, our English translations say, receive him as you would me. Mm-hmm. But those two words, you would, are not in the Greek. Those are English editorial additions to try to make better sense of it. But in the Greek, it just says, receive him as me, which really shows you the strength of the identification of Paul and Onesimus. Receive him as me.
Yeah, it makes me think of also the guest room that Paul asks. So you can imagine, it's like maybe Onesimus is going to be hanging out in the guest room now, you know, in the meantime, if you know, that's receive him as you would receive me. And I want this room, and maybe put him in there.
Oh, and he says, and by the way, I'm going to come visit one day.
Yeah. I'm going to check in, make sure that he's not, you know, serving tables or something in the house.
Yep.
So there, as I was looking through this, there's kind of two key verses in my head that really persuaded me that Paul is asking him to be liberated, and that would be verse 8 and verse 16. And I want to talk a little bit about verse 8 and this concept of him doing what is fitting. Mm-hmm. So this is a word that's used elsewhere, I believe in Colossians, when it says, you know, wives, submit to your husbands as is fitting in the Lord. And I think the ESV goes with something like, do what is required. The King James has that which is convenient. So can you talk about this category of what is fitting or becoming or proper? Because I kind of want to, my follow-up question would be, you know, is it a sin to not do what is fitting in this case?
Yeah, so it's a great, great point. I just checked. I have a Bible software where I can see the Greek real quick, and it's not exactly the same word. I was going to make a comparison to 1 Corinthians chapter 11, which also uses this kind of argument. It's not exactly the same word there, so I don't want to overstate it. But in 1 Corinthians 11, Paul talks about, you know, head coverings, also talks about long hair, things like that. And he makes an argument there about creation, and then the implications of creation to way that you, you know, the way you dress or the way that you present yourself. And it's a similar kind of idea. You do it because it's proper, it's right. And so you mentioned Paul talks about wives submitting to their husbands because it's proper, it's appropriate. This is a word that shows up in a lot of Greek literature. I believe it's Cicero. He's got a book on duties, and he talks about this concept of fittingness or propriety. And the idea is that it's not a law. You know, it's not like you must always do this, and if you don't, you're in sin. But the idea is it's the sort of thing you should do just because that's who you are, right? It follows from your identity and the situation. So, you know, you could think about, with wives submitting to husbands, that's a moral duty as well, but it's also consistent with the creation. That's why Adam and Eve were given to each other, to have this relationship. Adam was the head, Eve was taken out of him, and she was made in many ways to be his helper. So it's her identity to do that, right? It's appropriate and proper. Similarly, the way that we walk as Christians, you know, we walk in a way that is fitting. That's a term Paul uses, I think, in Colossians and in Ephesians. It's moral, right? If you're getting drunk, you're sleeping around, that's breaking the law. But it's also just not, it's not consistent with what you're saying you're all about. It doesn't make sense that you're telling everyone you're a new creature in Christ, you love what he's done for you, you want other people to know this, and it's had this transformational effect on you. So it's, you know, it's only right and appropriate, only fitting to live in a way that's consistent with that. So it's not less than moral, but it's more of it's less of a command. You know, you're not doing it just because you're commanded to do it. You're doing it because it's what flows naturally out of who you are and your situation. Yeah. And there can be a level of subjectivity to what's proper. What we decide about how long our hair should be, that can change. And you have to be, as a Christian, you have to be willing to put up with some amount of sort of disagreement from different locations and cultures. And the idea is that you're actually just looking to do what makes the most sense in your context, right? What would send that message to the people around you most clearly.
Yeah.
So in Philemon, do what's proper here is, again, you know, think about the big picture. I'm not just going to tell you what to do, but think about it. How does this make sense? What would most consistently and most completely indicate that you are receiving Onesimus as a brother and you're treating him like me?
Yeah. So as I was thinking about, I'm preaching through some of the laws in the Old Testament and, you know, in the deep weeds of Leviticus and Deuteronomy, and I was thinking about some of the slave laws in the Old Testament, which Paul would certainly have been familiar with. And I want to kind of give you kind of my speculative take on it and then get your feedback. So in verse 16, when he says, you know, receive him no longer as a slave, but more than a slave, you mentioned, yeah, some people try to take that as, all right, he's still your slave, but he's now also your brother too. And then we would say that in the flesh piece there is the key that's really saying, no, set him free. And if you look back at Leviticus 25, where it talks about Israelites are not allowed to enslave fellow Israelites, but they were allowed to have foreign slaves. And I'm just wondering if in Paul's head, he's thinking that since Onesimus has been converted, he now falls into a different category because he's now a part of the church. He's kind of an Israelite. He's a member of the church. And so now it would be improper to enslave a fellow Israelite. But he doesn't quote Leviticus here. I'm just wondering, is that possibly Paul's background logic for why he's coming to this position?
Yes, I think that's a really good connection. This is one of those passages, like you say, it's sort of the deep weeds of the Old Testament. So my most recent sermon when I preached on this, I had it in my notes, right? I'm like, all right, I'm going to talk about Leviticus 25. And then, of course, you get in the pulpit and the time's running out and say, okay, I don't have time to go to Leviticus 25. Yeah. But no, I think it's really important because if you were a Jew who was familiar with the Old Testament, the books of Moses, then you would certainly know this chapter. Talking about the Jubilee Law. The Jubilee is going to roll around in ancient Israel every 40 years. And in the Jubilee, you have your debts forgiven. You know, all your debts are gone. Property reverts back to its original owners. And slaves are set free. And so this is, it was a picture of redemption. I think in a lot of ways, Jesus is proclaiming the Jubilee when he says, you know, the Spirit has anointed me to preach good news to the poor, to set the captives free. That certainly has some Jubilee, that's from Isaiah, but it's got Jubilee meaning built into it. And yeah, in Leviticus 25, we see that you are not allowed to permanently enslave Israelites. You know, if you're a member of Israel, you can't permanently enslave an Israelite. You might temporarily, you know, have them be a hired servant who is like a slave, maybe for debt reasons or something, but eventually you have to let them go. And yeah, it says they're your brothers. You can't treat your brothers with rigor or with abuse. And God also explains that you can't treat his children like this. Mm-hmm. So Leviticus 25, verse 55, the children of Israel are servants to me. They are my servants who I brought out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So God is saying, my people can't be slaves in a permanent way to any humans. They can't be slaves to people because they're mine. Mm-hmm. They belong to me, so they have to be treated differently. So come to the gospel. Jesus is the fulfillment of all the Old Testament scriptures. And then the people that follow him, who become the church, I think are now the continuation of the covenant people. They are the new Israel. So even though we wouldn't apply the Jubilee in a direct way, you know, no Christian say, okay, after 40 years, your debts are all gone, even, you know, if you still owe. And we certainly don't kick people off their property and try to find the original owner. Yeah. We recognize that that has ceremonial law. That's a ceremonial law that can't be enforced in the new covenant. But we should still try to find the principle here. What's underneath it all that makes sense? And so perhaps the property, maybe that has a reference to the promised land. So maybe that's, you know, redemption, new heavens and new earth. Okay. But this business of being children of God, that would still hold up in a fairly straightforward way. Yeah. What has changed is that it's no longer limited to one tribal or ethnic group. Mm-hmm. Now it's all believers. Yeah. So a Gentile comes to Christ, he's now treated every bit as much as a son of God, a peculiar possession, people that Yahweh has a claim over. So the logic of Leviticus would say, you shouldn't treat Christians like slaves. You should set them free eventually.
Yeah. So how would you respond to someone who hears this and says, okay, maybe that's what Philemon is about, but in all the other kind of household code sections where it's talking about bond servants and slaves, Paul just says, you know, slaves obey your masters, masters don't be harsh to them. And so it makes Philemon at least kind of an outlier of liberation. It's like, if Paul really wanted this, why didn't he just bake that into his, you know, at the end of every letter, he also says, and yeah, and set your slaves free if you're a Christian.
Sure.
So yeah, why does he do it this way?
Yeah, so this is a good point. Now, we're using this word liberation, and I used it in a sermon recently, and I did it on purpose to kind of catch people's attention, to let them know the kind of things we're talking about. But it is a loaded word, right? There's this whole school of thought called liberation theology, which basically would say, yeah, you should always be freeing people all the time. The gospel is primarily a political transformation. That's not what I mean. I'm kind of using the word as a, you know, as a ear catcher to start having this conversation, but I'm not promoting liberation theology. I think the New Testament's very, very consistent. You don't call for immediate change, right? You don't just bust in and overturn everything. You don't say right away all slaves are free, and you don't, you know, you don't call for political rebellion, right? Paul and Peter both are submitting to non-Christian magistrates. They're counseling people to put up with all kinds of unfair situations and suffering. So we're not asking for any kind of immediate revolution. We're not really abolitionism in, you know, the 19th century American sense, which would be more of, you know, right now, right here, everyone be free. It's not that way. We're asking, Paul is asking Philemon to voluntarily, you know, of his own accord, choose to free this slave, and to do it in a way that works, right? Paul says, I'll pay anything he owes. Mm-hmm. I'll make up for the debt. You couldn't do that, you know, in every case. It's just, you don't have the resources. Paul's giving us a model for personal relationships, for voluntary freedom, and sort of an internal and incremental freeing of people. The way that I put it is Paul wants Christians to free others freely. Mm. You know, he wants us to choose to do it and then to do it of our own account in a way that works over time. But he understands that it's not always going to be possible. Again, in our day, we have such a hard time thinking about a society where slavery was real and pervasive. Sure, we talk about it in the American history sense, but even there, we talk about it like, you know, good versus evil, right? Cosmic forces of righteousness and darkness. And nobody today will admit in public that they could even conceive of slavery being tolerated, right? That's like just so out there. But the reality is, in human history, it was all over the place, right? Pretty much every society has had slavery. Sometimes it was more brutal, sometimes less. It was not always racial, like in America, that's true. But they still owned people as property. And in the first century, a Roman slave master, he very likely could kill a slave and wouldn't go to jail. So even though it's not the same as American slavery, it still doesn't pass, you know, our ethical requirements. And that was normal. That was all across the empire. And entire, you know, kind of economic structures were built on it. And you can't change that stuff quickly. And people today, we act like you could, but why are you still buying your iPhones? Right? Like, if you're so serious about immediate freedom and abolition, why do you continue to participate in a global marketplace that we know is built on slave labor in the form of, you know, sweatshops or in some cases actual ethnic slavery? We all know that's happening in China and other parts of Asia. But we just, you know, either don't want to think about it or it's too much, right? More than what you or I can change with our resources. And so that's how it was in the first century. You know, you couldn't just say, all right, free all the slaves. If you did that, you'd immediately have political chaos. Probably the authorities are shutting you down. And then also, what are the slaves going to do?
Yeah.
You know, they don't have money. Many of them don't have education, they don't have resources, they don't have property. You know, where are you going to send them? These are very difficult things. And in the 19th century, American, they didn't figure it out. Yeah. You know, they had all sorts of ideas of what they were going to do, and eventually didn't do any of them. Yeah. So we're still dealing with the effects of that. None of this is to make light of the situation. Obviously, it's terrible to have that sort of society. And we should desire liberation, absolutely. We should want to do what we can. But all of this is a call to just treat it like real history, right? Real life on planet Earth. And Paul is not promoting any utopian ideas. He's not promoting revolution. He's trying to work slowly from within the system. And he is reminding us that even if we can't change all of our earthly conditions, we are still free in Christ. gospel is still true, and we have a more important salvation. The things of heaven really are more ultimate. A paradigm for seeing this is 1 Corinthians 7. 1 Corinthians 7, starting in verse 17, Paul just says, as God has distributed to each one, as the Lord has called each one, so let him walk. And then verse 20, let each one remain in the same calling in which he was called. And he talks about circumcision, he talks about marriage, and he talks about slavery. And 1 Corinthians 7:21 is really kind of a crazy verse for modern people to hear. He says, were you called while a slave? Do not be concerned about it. It's almost like he's saying, don't worry about it. Again, startling for modern audiences, right? If we told people that today, just don't worry about it, they would be very angry, you know. But that's what Paul says. Don't be concerned about it. It's not the most important thing. But then he does add, if you can be made free, then use it. So I interpret that to mean if the opportunity does come up, then take it, right? Freedom is better. It's more helpful, more useful. So if it's available, definitely take it, get free. But if it's not, then that is permissible. You can still live that as a Christian. And Paul says, because really we're equal. We're equally free and we're equally slaves. So 1 Corinthians 7, 22, he who is called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's freed man. Free in the Lord. Likewise, he who is called while free is Christ's slave. So the slave is free, and the free man is a slave. Yeah. Paul is trying to get us to think in this sort of spiritual way. And by the way, this argument I'm making right now, this is why so many earlier Christians would say that Paul is not even calling for Onesimus to be freed. Right? They would just apply this all the way. You know, the slaves are free, the free are slaves, and we just accept our calling and we persevere. But what I'm arguing is that Paul does say, if it's available, then take your freedom. Mm-hmm. And his letter to Philemon, he's explaining how that can be made available, right? set him free for the sake of the church. If he owes you anything, I'll pay it. Treat him like me.
Yeah. So right now, it seems like in the conversations about social justice, Black Lives Matter and stuff, and some of the woke kind of conversation, one of the tools that both the world and people even within the church have used to kind of silence a lot of Christians is by just saying, you know, your Bible isn't radical enough. You know, they're basically saying you don't have the moral high ground. And then they also have some good examples they can point to where Christians didn't apply, you know, they defended slavery as an institution in certain ways that they probably shouldn't have. So how do we even have a conversation? Because it feels like you're just already back on your heels, and it takes some nuance, right? So it takes thought to go through some of these text and then to try to explain that to someone who's yelling at you, you know?
Yeah, for sure. You know, for most situations, you probably can't have this conversation, right? And boy, I've made mistakes in my life where I didn't know when to say no thanks, you know, to a debate. Most people, yeah, they're not gonna be able to have this conversation, but points that we can say here. Well, first of all, again, what I said earlier, you've got to be realistic about history. We have certain standards today that were constructed based on centuries of progress. Our concept of freedom, you know, political independence, equality, this stuff was worked out through a lot of conflict. It goes back to the Middle Ages and little by little, step by step. And our standards, what we expect, what we think of as sort of normative, it's actually historically very, very limited, very peculiar, right? We live in a time in history that doesn't represent most of human history. It's also not the same as most of the world, right? Even today, if you look at the majority of the world, they don't have, you know, liberal values like that. I'm using liberal in the sense of like freedom and equality, that sort of thing. They just don't have those. So we can't judge everybody else based on our current standards, even if we like our standards and think those are good. Mm-hmm. We have to be honest about how complicated history is. Also, the argument that, well, Christians have done bad things and they supported slavery in the past, that's true, but we need to be also aware that that's not universal. And so in the Presbyterian history, the Scots Presbyterians, they opposed slavery pretty much from the beginning. They knew what it was like to be the underpower, right? The people who had were oppressed, who had to take second or third place. They didn't appreciate being dominated. So they were never supporters of slavery. And you have, even in the 19th century, you have letters and writings from Scottish Presbyterians totally rebuking the American Presbyterians. So there was diversity all the way. And even in America, right, there were voices who were more critical of the situation. And certainly by the time you get to someone like Benjamin Warfield, a Presbyterian theologian at Old Princeton, he's after the Civil War, of course, but he's still living in a time of great racial inequality. He's aware of the problems. You know, he's talking about it. He's calling people's attention to the true biblical teaching. So we can grant and acknowledge true failures of the past, but I don't think we should say, well, that's universal of everybody. And we also have to be realistic about history. You know, people change, communal social values change, things that are clear and obvious now were not always clear and obvious, and things that are possible now were not always possible. And so I think we have to hold on to those views. We're humble about it. But yeah, that's what we do. And then we try to demonstrate what I think is the true biblical teaching here. So as I've done with this book in Philemon, we can show this is one way in which the gospel promotes freedom. It's not the same as the world's way. You know, this is not a BLM manifesto. It's really not. It's very different. But it is, I think, an internally consistent biblical picture of how we can promote freedom.
Yeah. I think it's been a fun book for me to have to wrestle with and think through and then try to apply. And as I think one of the most helpful things, especially like when you're young, you're very idealistic. You know, you read something and it's easy to just have like these people before me were idiots and I've got the answers. And it's really helpful to read history, read people on both sides, and really to try to put yourselves in their shoes. And you realize, yeah, it is complicated. It is difficult. And there's good men on both sides. And it's just like there's good men today that disagree about all sorts of things, whether that's the, you know, whether the churches should be open, whether we should defy the government or not. It's like there's people all across the board on that. And it's like, we need to be able to have the love, charity, and wisdom to have those debates in the middle of fighting and recognizing this actually is spiritual warfare. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times we forget that that's actually what we're doing. We're wrestling against the, you know, principalities and powers in this time.
Yeah. And that last point, it really is important. We can't lose sight of it. You know, for Paul, social and political change, that's good, that can come from the gospel, but it's always second. You know, it's always second place to our pursuit of Christ, our resisting sin and temptation, and seeking the kingdom of God in any way that's possible. That spiritual dimension is always first, and then the social and political ramifications are ways that we apply that. And they can be different depending on place and time. And we can have different, different sort of paces, how fast and how quickly we get to certain applications.
Yeah. Stephen, maybe we'll close. Do you have any maybe resources or books or things that you might point people to who are interested in trying to do some of the reading and research on this? Is there any really good resources that you've come across that you would advise other people?
So, yes and no. The first book that kind of clued me in on a really, what I thought was a really helpful way to read this was N.T. Wright has got a little commentary. He's got that series, Paul, for Everyone. I might have it behind me somewhere. Yeah, here it is. So this is the one on the prison letters, Paul for Everyone by N.T. Wright. And in here, he has a very short treatment of Philemon. And he gives it a pretty good reading, a very like, he sees Paul as enacting Christ, basically. Paul as being the Christ figure in his actions. But he cites Luther, Martin Luther. So that got me interested to go read Luther. The problem with reading Luther is that you're not going to be able to find Luther's commentary anywhere. it is in English, but you got to get into that giant series, you know, Luther's Works, the entire collection, which is as big as a whole shelf. So you're probably... you're either going to dish out the big bucks to buy that in an electronic format, like a Logos Bible software sells it, or go to a good seminary or Bible college, that might be in your area, and get them to buy it electronically, and you can read it there. So Martin Luther's commentary, very helpful. That's probably the best single edition.
Okay. Well, thanks. Stephen, really appreciate you coming on. Hope you stay warm up north. I don't know. I guess you're basically in the Northwest still, right? You're just
We're warmer than Moscow, Idaho, any day. Yeah, our weather, we're basically Seattle, right? So whatever it's like in Seattle, it's like that here.
Yeah. Just maybe more freedom.
yeah, we have less autonomous zones in Seattle, yeah. For sure.
That's great. Well, if you are sojourning through the Bible Reading Challenge, read Philemon. I think I may have been reformed now. I'm a Philemon fan, but keep on reading and check out those books. Until next time, keep on reading.